And sunnier weather here for Wednesday, whereas across the north and west it will stay cloudy and breezy once again. And that's your weather. Back now to Steve.
Elizabeth, thanks very much. And I'll bring you the shipping bulletin in 15 minutes. This is BBC Radio 4. Now, following the death of Nelson Mandela, we've a change to the advertised book of the week. This week we present Long Walk to Freedom, Nelson Mandela's autobiography. The reader is the South African actor John Carney.
Apart from life, a strong constitution, and an abiding connection to the Tembu royal house, the only thing my father bestowed upon me at birth was a name, Rholihlahla. In Xhosa, this literally means pulling the branch of a tree, but its colloquial definition could more accurately be termed troublemaker. I do not believe that names are destiny, but in later years, friends and relatives ascribed to my birth name the many storms I have both caused and weathered. I was born on the 18th of July 1918 at Mvezo, a tiny village in the Transkei, in what was then the British colony of South Africa. It is a beautiful country of rolling hills, fertile valleys, and a thousand rivers which keep the lands green even in winter. My father had four wives, the third of whom was my mother. He was an acknowledged custodian of Xhosa history and advisor to kings. I am a member of Madiba clan, named after a Tembu chief who ruled in the Transkei in the 18th century. On my first day of school, my teacher gave each of us an English name and said that was the name we would answer to in school. This was the custom among Africans in those days. The education I received was one in which British ideas, British culture, British institutions were automatically assumed to be superior. There was no such thing as African culture. That day, Miss Ngabi told me my new name was Nelson. One night, when I was 9 years old, I was aware of a commotion. My father was lying on his back in what seemed like an endless fit of coughing. Even to my young eyes, it was clear that my father was not long for this world. He was ill with some type of lung disease, but it was not diagnosed as my father had never visited a doctor. He took a turn for the worse. Late that night, he called, "Bring me my tobacco." My mother thought it was unwise that he have tobacco in his current state, but he persisted in calling for it, and eventually his pipe was handed to him. My father smoked and became calm. He continued smoking for perhaps an hour, and then, his pipe still lit, he died. My father's passing changed my whole life. After a brief period of mourning, my mother informed me that I would be leaving the village. We travelled by foot and in silence until the sun was sinking. Late in the afternoon, at the bottom of a shady valley surrounded by trees, we came upon a large and gracious home at the centre of a village. This was the provincial capital of Tembuland, the royal residence of the regent, Chief Jongindaba Dalinje. He had offered to become my guardian. My mother gave no sermons, no words of wisdom, no kisses. I suspect that she did not want me to feel bereft at her departure, and so was matter of fact. I was quickly caught up in the new daily life. To me, it was a magical kingdom. When I was not at school, I was a ploughboy, a wagon guide, a shepherd. Justice, the elder son of the regent and 4 years older than me, became my first hero after my father. It was here that I developed my interest in African history. Chiefs and herdsmen came to the capital to settle disputes. Some days they would finish early and sit around telling stories. I hovered silently and listened. The most ancient of the chiefs would regale the gathered elders with ancient tales. Chief Joyi said that African people lived in relative peace until the coming of the Abelung, the white people who arrived from across the sea with fire-breathing weapons. I did not yet know that the real history of our country was not to be found in the standard British textbooks. In January 1934, when I was 16, the Regent decided that it was time I became a man. In Xhosa tradition, this is achieved through circumcision. In my tradition, an uncircumcised male cannot be heir to his father's wealth, cannot marry, or officiate in tribal rituals. It is not just a surgical procedure, but a lengthy and elaborate ritual in preparation for manhood. At dawn, when the stars were still in the sky, we began our preparations. We were escorted to the river to bathe in its cold waters, a ritual that signified our purification before the ceremony. The ceremony was at midday, and we were commanded to stand in a row in a clearing some distance away from the river, clad only in our blankets. As the ceremony began, with drums pounding, we were ordered to sit on the blanket on the ground with our legs spread out in front of us. I was tense and anxious. Flinching or crying out was a sign of weakness and stigmatized one's manhood. To the right, out of the corner of my eye, I could see a thin elderly man kneel in front of the first boy. The old man would use his assegai or spear to change us from boys to men with a single blow. Suddenly, I heard the first boy cry out, "Dindo da!" "I am a man." Before I knew it, the old man was kneeling in front of me. Without a word, he took my foreskin, pulled it forward, and then in a single motion brought down his assegai. I felt as if fire was shooting through my veins. I buried my chin into my chest, and then I recovered and called out, "Dindo da!" At the end of our seclusion, the lodges and all the contents were burned, destroying our last links to childhood, and a great ceremony was held to welcome us as men to society. The main speaker of the day began conventionally, and then his tone changed. "There sit our sons," he said, "healthy and handsome, the pride of our nation. We have promised them manhood. But it is an empty, illusory promise. For all black South Africans are a conquered people. We are slaves in our own country. We are tenants in our own soil. We have no strength, no power, no control of our own destiny in the land of our birth. These young men will go to the cities where they will live in shacks and drink cheap alcohol. The abilities, the intelligence, the promise will be squandered in their attempts to eke out a living, doing the simplest and most mindless chores for the white men." At the time, I thought he was enormously ungrateful. But without exactly understanding why, his words soon began to work in me. In 1937, when I was 18, I joined Justice at Hilltown, the Wesleyan College southwest of Mthatha. Hilltown was the largest African school below the equator, with more than 1,000 students, male and female. We were taught and believed that the best ideas were English ideas, the best government was English government, and the best men were Englishmen. But in my final year at Hilltown, an event occurred for me that was like a comet streaking across the night sky. The great Xhosa poet Khune Mqhayi was going to visit the school. On the appointed morning, the door opened and out walked a black man dressed in a leopard skin karos, carrying an assegai on either hand. The sight of a black man in tribal dress was electrifying. It seemed to turn the universe upside down. At one stage, during his performance, he raised the assegai into the air and accidentally hit the curtain wire. He stopped and walked backward and forward in thought. And then he exclaimed that this incident symbolized the clash between the African culture and that of Europe. His voice rose and he said, "We cannot allow these foreigners to take over our nation. I predict that one day the forces of African society will achieve a momentous victory over the interloper. I could hardly believe my ears. His boldness in speaking of such delicate matters in the presence of whites seemed utterly astonishing. It began to alter my perception of the white men whom I had automatically considered my benefactor. Until 1960, the University College of Fort Hare was the only residential center of higher education for blacks in South Africa. It was a beacon for African scholars from all over Southern, Central, and Eastern Africa. For young black South Africans like myself, it was Oxford and Cambridge, Harvard and Yale, all rolled into one. In my first year there, I studied English, anthropology, politics, native administration, and Roman Dutch law. I believed a university degree was a passport not only to community leadership, but financial success. As a BA, I would finally be able to restore to my mother the wealth and prestige that she had lost after my father's death. I would build her a proper home with a garden and modern furniture and fittings. This was my dream, and it seemed within reach. At the end of that year, I returned home to the Regent. A few weeks after my homecoming, he summoned Justice and myself. "My children," he said in a very somber tone, "I fear that I am not much longer for this world, and before I journey to the land of my ancestors, it is my duty to see my two sons properly married. I have accordingly arranged unions for both of you." The Regent was acting in accordance with Tembu law, and his motives could not be maligned. But I could not go through with this marriage, which I considered unfair and ill-advised. At the same time, I believed that I could no longer remain under the Regent's guidance if I was to reject his plan for me. Justice agreed, and the two of us decided the only option was to run away to the City of Gold, to Johannesburg. We rode the bus to the estate agent on Market Street, a dense and rollicking thoroughfare with trams groaning with passengers. Sidewalk vendors on every street. A sense of wealth and riches were just around the corner. I was introduced to a man with an intelligent and kindly face, dressed in a double-breasted suit. Despite his youth, he seemed to be a man of the world. His name was Walter Sisulu. He was already a force in the local community. I explained about my recent ambition to be a lawyer and how I intended to register at the University of South Africa. I neglected to tell him of the circumstances of my arrival in Johannesburg. He looked me over and said there was a white Jewish lawyer with whom he had worked who was interested in African education. He would talk to Sidelski about taking me on as an articled clerk. The firm of Witkin, Sidelski and Eidelman was one of the largest law firms in the city and handled business from blacks as well as whites. Mr. Sidelski was involved with African education, donating money and time to African schools. A splendid, courtly man with a pencil mustache, he took a genuine interest in my welfare and future. I was then just 22 years old, still finding my feet as a man, as a resident of Johannesburg, and as an employee of a white law firm.
Long Walk to Freedom, the autobiography of Nelson Mandela, is read by the South African actor John Carney. It's abridged by Michelle in Wonder and produced by Chris Wallace. It's a Watershed production for BBC Radio 4 and continues tomorrow when Nelson Mandela becomes a married man and a political activist. Now, is sailing by. All of it. This is BBC Radio 4. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Tuesday the 10th of December. There are warnings of gales in Trafalgar, Fitzroy, Seoul, Shannon, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800, low 100...